University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor at New School University, has written a number of books. Among his latest is the book Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Also has a radio show that broadcasts on Pacifica radio stations and community radio stations around the country called Economic Update. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hadi Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the Tuesday KBOO Evening News.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street from 5 to 9 p.m. The community parade will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m. with an after-party on Clinton Street going until 9. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, parents and other community members rallied for improved career in technical education and science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics programs in Portland public schools.
Portland labor activist Francisco Aguirre pled not guilty yesterday to charges that he illegally re-entered the United States.
And the state legislature ended its 2015 session yesterday, so we hear from Representative Lou Frederick about police reform.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 7th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Portland labor activist Francisco Aguirre pled not guilty yesterday to charges that he illegally re-entered the United States. The native El Salvadorian was reported in 1999 after being convicted of drug delivery charges. Francisco claims that the judge who deported him violated his due process by incorrectly explaining the options available to him. The immigration officers claim that Francisco would have been deported even if the judge had given him the correct information. You may remember his story from late last year when Francisco took refuge in a Northeast Portland church as part of the Sanctuary Movement after being charged with illegal re-entry. The Sanctuary Movement provides protection from ICE to immigrants such as Francisco Aguirre.
A student at Portland State University notified the KBOO News Department that there were three people patrolling the campus yesterday afternoon waving a large Confederate flag. The flag has been in the news recently as Alabama decided to remove its Confederate flags in the state capitol, and South Carolina is currently debating a bill to do the same. Following the killing of 9 black worshippers in a church in South Carolina several weeks ago, white racist groups, like the KKK, have rallied around the Confederate flag, while anti-racists have called for its removal. This is not the first time that white racists have openly marched through downtown Portland. Several years ago, a group of 10 people marched through the Portland waterfront carrying signs against what they called white genocide. This is a term referring to a paranoid fantasy by some white racist groups that, quote, oceans of non-whites are flooding what they call white countries in order to, quote, eradicate the white race. This was a term used often by murderer Dylan Roof in his racist manifesto that he posted in advance of his massacre of black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina. Portland State University officials did not respond to a request for comment on the presence of a group parading around the campus carrying a Confederate flag.
The Oregon legislature gaveled its session to a close yesterday. Supporters of criminal justice reform made great strides in Salem this year. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with State Representative Lou Frederick this morning to learn more.
Representative Frederick, you had some terrific successes this year in the legislature. Of course, it just adjourned last night. I was just reading over your bill, HB 2002, on racial profiling. How do you feel that the session went?
Well, I think the session went extremely well. I've been saying that if I started to complain, I really needed to look over my shoulder and expecting lightning bolts. We actually managed to do an incredible a lot of work. And it wasn't just my bill. It was the Center for Intercultural Organizing. It was the Albina Ministerial Alliance. It was a whole series of folks who got together over the years to build a really good case to explain why we needed some of these legislation.
Now, it wasn't just racial profiling. You also had a bill on body cams and the ability to get audio. How do you think that the police are going to respond now that they've got these opportunities to do better?
Well, I think that I've already heard from a number of police officers. They are pleased with the direction that this is going. Now, there are obviously going to be some folks who are not going to be pleased. But they are starting to be marginalized because of the way that they are handling things. I am relatively pleased with the direction we're going. I don't think we're already there yet. I think there are some things we're going to need to tweak. But at this particular point, there's a good direction and at least an acknowledgement of some of the issues that people have been talking about for decades have started to be addressed.
Now, the legislature has just adjourned. You have a short session in February next year, and then it starts all over again. What should people out here in the public be doing in the meantime?
Well, I think that part of the question is, first of all, looking at what we managed to get accomplished in this session, which was an extraordinary amount of really good work with a lot of support from the public and everyone. But the other thing is, you know, the real key behind the legislature is to try to find some way to make things better for the people around us. But we need to know what those things might be. What would help the folks in Coos Bay, in Portland, in LeGrand, what would help them have a better life? Would housing issues, what kind of health issues, what kind of education issues, economic security things, what actually would help there? That's part of the discussion that needs to be held, and I think we're going to continue to have that discussion. But right now, we managed to do extremely well in getting some things accomplished, and I am very pleased. We obviously still have issues in housing. We have issues in health care, mental health care. We have issues that we need to really address related to education, huge issues regarding education. We have issues regarding transportation. We need to find some way to make sure that not only are we have good roads and things, but that we have safe roads and safe safety issues. We haven't really addressed the issues related to diesel and to pollution, certainly in my district with asthma as a major problem. So I think we're going to be looking at a number of things. I'm hearing from people already who want to have us address more issues related to police accountability, and how we managed to get not only a better police force, but recapture or attempt to capture the kind of support, the kind of credibility that we need to have in order to be an effective system here. So that's part of what we're going to have discussions about, and I hope we'll be able to get something done about.
Terrific. Representative Frederick, any last thoughts for the listeners?
Well, just to thank you. I know that the folks with KBOO kept the conversation going. We need to keep that taking place. It's going to take a while. This does not come easily. It's not a simple answer, but we need to have people out there talking about those issues and talking with each other and all of their legislators. So you're going to have lots of town halls in the next few months of people saying, this is what we did. What do you want to have happen? And I'm hoping that we'll have the folks from all sorts of sections of the state involved in those discussions.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Representative Frederick, thank you so very much for all your work and for your time.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
A group of Portlanders held a solidarity action yesterday with the people of Lac Mégantique, Quebec, commemorating the one-year anniversary of the worst oil train derailment in Canada's history. The disaster is the most deadly explosion so far of oil from the new fracking development in North Dakota's Bakken Field, which holds an especially volatile mixture of oil and gas. Bakken oil is now regularly moved through Portland and southern Washington, mainly by rail, to the ARC Logistics facility on the Willamette River in Portland. Portland activists temporarily shut down the oil train shipments to the city's only facility for transporting oil, run by the company ARC Logistics. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at the civil disobedience action and brings us the sound of the protest.
It was a tragedy of incredible magnitude, bringing untold suffering to the friends and family of these people and to all of the beings in the nature that surrounds this area. And that's why we're here today, to mourn these losses still deeply felt after 2 years since the quote-unquote accident. But it really wasn't an accident, was it? It was a preventable disaster. You see, the oil moving through Lac Mégantique was mislabeled. It was labeled as a packing group 3 instead of a packing group 2 or 1, which refers to much more dangerous substances with lower flash points. And the train was carrying the most volatile oil to be had, oil from the Bracken Shale fracking fields. Moreover, a hazardous materials inspection team had issued safety warnings about these oil trains back in 2011 and 2012, but no changes have been made to the tank cars since then. Even as federal regulators discuss new safety measures, updating or retrofitting the standard petroleum tank cars, reducing train speeds near towns, and performing spot inspections of oil trains. Oil trains continue to roll through towns and cities across the United States and Canada. In fact, instead of reducing the train loads until proper safety methods can be put into place, the quantity of oil being shipped by rail across North America has been increasing dramatically. And yes, most of it is this same hyper-volatile oil that killed our brothers and sisters to the north. According to the American Association of Railroads, there were 9,500 rail cars carrying crude oil in 2008. Now there are close to 500,000 of them shipping oil in outdated cars on tracks that are rarely inspected and through towns and cities ill-equipped to deal with disaster. It comes as no surprise then that since the Lac Mégantique disaster, there have been a string of oil train collisions and derailments with no sign of abatement. Oil trains continue to pass through major cities, small towns, and national parks. Public safety is clearly being trumped by fossil fuel profiteering. Now, oil companies know their days are numbered, but they want to make as much profit as possible, no matter how many lives are sacrificed, no matter how many ecosystems are destroyed. And so they do it without any public input, and in many cases, even our emergency response teams don't know when they're coming through. But today, we are here to say that this has got to stop. 10 to 12 oil trains are coming through the Pacific Northwest every day. It's just a matter of time before we have our own disaster, unless we stop these trains.
Today's action is part of a series of actions taking place all over North America and Canada to stand in memory with the 47 lives lost, and also call to an end for oil trains and fossil fuel infrastructure everywhere. We are currently living in a time of climate chaos here in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon. We're already experiencing the effects of temperature rise, and things are projected to get a lot worse if we don't transition away from fossil fuels immediately. And so faith and environmental groups have gathered here today at ARC Logistics, which is Portland's in-town oil terminal, to call for an end to oil trains, which are also known as bomb trains because of their propensity to explode, and stand for safe and healthy communities everywhere.
Is there a political body that you're protesting to? Who do you expect to take action?
We are hoping that the city of Portland will take action as they establish their fossil fuel export policy to actually broadly call for an end to large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure and instead promote reinvestment into renewable clean energy.
There are children here today. There are people here today in their 80s. Every generation on Earth is being touched by the fossil fuel industry's terrible misdeeds, by their crimes. It is the only industry that can spew poison into the atmosphere without impact, without on their bottom line, that can get away with the kind of misdeeds that they do.
Those were the voices of protesters who gathered at the ARC Logistics oil terminal in Portland yesterday to protest the transport of oil through the city and state by rail.
At the Portland School Board meeting last night, residents expressed concern that students at Roosevelt High are not getting adequate education when it comes to science, technology, engineering, and math, known by the acronym STEM. The need for better STEM education is a hot button in the Portland public school system, most notably with Roosevelt High School, which received $10 million less than its neighboring school, Franklin High School, for STEM programs. At last night's school board meeting, three new board members were sworn in: Julia Sparza Brown, Mike Rosen, and Paul Anthony. Their first experience as school board members was hearing the testimony of community members, teachers, and parents calling on school superintendent Carol Smith to consider expanding the STEM program at Roosevelt. Maria Da Silva, who is a parent of two children that will be attending Roosevelt High School in the fall, expressed her concern to the school board about providing equitable programs for Latino kids at Roosevelt.
I just wanted to share my space with amazing students and a parent. My kids will go to Beach Elementary School, and we will be bringing them to Roosevelt. And I want, when they come, to have an equitable program, a program that is decent for Latino, for the 50% for the 70% of students of colors, and that will keep growing. You know that the graduation rate is 53%. This is not acceptable. And anyone coming to the new board, you know, you gotta clean the house, you gotta build the house, you gotta repair the house, you gotta do whatever you can, because you just don't come and keep building in the mess. You know, kids know these, we teach this to kids. This is why we got a model. Roosevelt High School, they deserve the same programs that Franklin, hiding $10 million, saving $10 million, putting them aside just because the area is impoverished and the students are marginalized. It's not okay. And we will hold you accountable. Thank you so much. Gracias.
KBOO's Sequoyna Wright asked one of the newest school board members, Julia Sparza Brown, about how she plans to support concerned parents and community leaders who are calling for fair and equitable STEM programs.
I am third generation, so I'm not Spanish was not my first language, but I can manage in Spanish, so I want to be able to reach out to all parents in small community groups, not necessarily at school. So
sure.
I'm hoping to find places that are comfortable for the community that we can go to and have meaningful dialogues around what it is that they see happening with their children and what they want and how we can make sure that all kids get there. So that's huge to me that I support that community and all communities of color and kids that also have disabilities, because historically they have not made great achievement either. So we need to change for all kids.
To find out more about the Portland Public School District plans into the fall season and 2016 school year, board minutes can be found at the Portland Public Schools website under Regular School Board Meetings.
Last Thursday, Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian ordered the bakers who refused to make a wedding cake for a lesbian couple to pay the couple $135,000. Avakian found that the couple suffered prolonged emotional and physical pain as a result of this refusal of service. When the owners of the bakery first received the complaint from the Department of Justice in 2013, they contacted right-wing media outlets. Avakian's order also found the bakers responsible for the suffering caused by the resulting media attention and harassment. The order awarded no monetary damages related to this media harassment. Avakian also ordered the bakers to stop denying services to customers based on sexual orientation and to end all advertisements or public statements expressing intent to discriminate based on sexual orientation. Discriminating based on sexual orientation is illegal under Oregon law.
U.S. soccer currently has one of the largest gender wage gaps in any workplace. On Sunday, the U.S. women's team was ensured a spot to win the World Cup after beating Japan. The U.S. versus Japan women's game was the most viewed soccer game ever in the United States, including both men's and women's games. However, FIFA paid the women's team significantly less than any other men's game. The women's team was awarded just $2 million for their win, which is a fourth of what the U.S. men's team got after losing their game last year. Currently, the U.S. women's team are world champions, whereas the men's team is ranked number 27. The total payout for the Men's World Cup last year is nearly 40 times as much as the Women's World Cup this year.
The West Virginia Department of Motor Vehicles can no longer dictate how trans people can dress for driver's license photos. The policy that many LGBTQ activists consider unconstitutional was officially changed on July 1st. This happened after three trans women threatened to sue after being harassed and forced to remove makeup at the DMV last year. Kristen Skinner is one of the three women and says that it is such a critical thing to us. It's not an easy process coming to terms with this, and to have somebody else more or less invalidate you at the state level is horrible. South Carolina made a similar policy change this year after settling a lawsuit filed by a trans teen. Michael Silverman is the director at the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund and says that the struggle for transgender individuals to obtain proper identification photos is a practical issue as well as a civil rights issue. A gender-conflicted driver's license photo can harm a person's ability to work or receive proper employment benefits, among other things. It is not clear how many state DMVs force people to conform to gender norms for a driver's license photo.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Is it really illegal to think outside the box? This is the provocative title of one of the chapters in a new community rights organizing primer published both in print and online by the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, the primary organization in the U.S. spearheading the community rights movement. Today I'll be sharing an excerpt from this chapter with you. Here it is. What is it that keeps us from getting what we want in our communities? Why can't we say no to harmful activities? The short answer is the law. A handful of legal doctrines make it illegal for communities to govern on important issues like fracking, factory farms, large-scale energy infrastructure projects, and commercial water extraction. Many people work hard to create sustainable communities, but these legal doctrines keep us boxed in by a system of law that routinely restricts local lawmaking and tells us that we are beyond our authority, or it's a state issue, not a local issue. We'll use the issue of fracking, although you can insert almost any issue that your community is concerned about, to illustrate how these legal doctrines preempt our decision-making, legalize the harms that come from fracking, and protect the industry from citizen opposition. Looking at the diagram, you'll notice the doctrines of state preemption and Dillon's rule. Preemption means the state legislature enacts laws that removes authority from the community to govern on a particular issue. Dillon's rule complements state preemption by defining the legal relationship between the state and the municipality as that of a parent to a child. In the case of fracking, the abusive parental state has slapped the municipal child's hand and told them not to touch decisions about fracking. In doing this, the people living within the municipality are deprived of the right to protect their own rights. Looking at the legal doctrine of nature as property, on the right side of the diagram, we see that nature is considered property under the law. Anyone with a title to property has the legal right to destroy it. With a permit from the state, the harms to ecosystems and the community members who rely on those ecosystems are legalized. Nature and human beings who do not have a title to the land or a financial interest in that land lack legal standing to argue in court to protect the ecosystem. With fracking, title of ownership or a lease with a drilling company trumps the health, safety, and welfare of the community and the viability of the ecosystem. It's the same for GMOs, water mining, sludge dumping, etc. At the bottom of the diagram is corporate privilege. Often referred to as corporate rights or personhood, it means that corporations claim rights to protections of free speech, First Amendment, money as speech, protections from search and seizure, Fourth Amendment, due process and lost future profits, Fifth Amendment, takings clause, and equal protection, 14th Amendment. Contracts clause protections, civil rights laws, and commerce laws further amplify corporate power to override local decision-making. The fourth legal doctrine on the left side of the diagram, entitled the regulatory fallacy, suggests there's a way out of the box. The permitting process and the regulations supposedly enforced by regulatory agencies are intended to create a sense of protection and objective oversight. By working through regulatory agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency and our state agencies, we're told we can protect our community. We can challenge permit applications and demand regulations be enforced. Except, by their very definition, regulatory agencies regulate the amount of harm that takes place. When they issue permits, they give cover to the applicant against liability to the community for the legalized harm. We're encouraged to come to the hearing if we're opposed to fracking. No one bothers to tell us that no matter how harmful fracking is, municipalities cannot ban anything permitted by the state. We present our 3-minute impassioned oration about the risk to community health. But in the end, nothing we say must be taken into account by the agency in the decision to issue the permit. If the application is clerically in order and complete, the permit is given. The harms are legalized. The permitting agency is in business to facilitate the issuance of the permit, not to protect people or the ecosystem. The idea that regulations protect us is a fallacy. By their very definition, they permit harm, and we're taught that our best option is to regulate just how much of it we're required to accept. You might argue, but zoning lets us stop harms, right? Well, not really. Zoning allows us, in most cases, to decide where industrial damage can occur. In other words, we get to choose which part of our community we want sacrificed to the harmful corporate activity. While our legal system creates the illusion that we have a democracy, state preemption and Dillon's rule, nature as property, corporate rights, and the regulatory fallacy all funnel us into a trap where we're told, when it comes to actual governing and creating sustainable communities, we are beyond our authority. The final blockade to community self-government is the black hole of doubt, the black spot in the middle of the diagram. We think we're not smart enough, strong enough, or empowered enough. We literally do not believe we have the inalienable right to govern. Sally Kempton, author and feminist, says, quote, it's hard to defeat an enemy who has outposts in your head, unquote. In a democratic nation, self-government should not be a foreign idea. I have been reading an excerpt from the new Community Rights Organizing Primer, published both in print and online by the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Copies are available locally at 100fires.com. That's 100fires.com. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter as CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Preference at 6. Preference is hosted by Alan Silver, who will be joined by Haley O'Shaughnessy, an activist and scholar, who asks us to question how the focus on gay marriage excludes transgender folks and hinders true radical activism among queer and trans communities. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is once again hot and dry. Tonight it will cool off to about 62. North-northwest wind, 5 to 8 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1863, Confederate General Robert E. Lee reports his defeat at Gettysburg to President Jefferson Davis. In 1969, the U.S. begins to withdraw troops from South Vietnam. And in 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor becomes the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court. And Abba Ibn says that history teaches us that men and nations behave wisely once they have exhausted all other alternatives.
It's 5:31, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As you might imagine, being poor means a life of sacrifices, frustrations, depression, and constant struggle. So what is it about Republican office holders that caused them to go out of their way to make poor people's lives even harder? GOP governors, Congress critters, and other officials perniciously insist that access to food stamps and other public assistance must be as burdensome and humiliating as possible. The latest example comes from the two Republican members of the Federal Communications Commission, which intends to expand a public subsidy called Lifeline, extending broadband internet service to all poor households. Universal access to the web is touted as essential to America's educational advancement and global competitiveness. Also, some 70% of teachers now assign homework, requiring every student to do online searches. So our national interest and simple fairness say everyone should be able to connect. Yet, even though Lifeline was started in 1985 by the Republican saint Ronald Reagan, the two FCC Republicans voted no on extending this sensible idea. Luckily, they were outvoted, but they then demanded a requirement that poor families must publicly reveal that they are poor. The two Scrooges are subjecting these families to a daunting and humiliating bureaucratic process, which will prevent many kids from getting the internet access that everyone needs for education success. This is Jim Hightower saying, come on, the quote subsidy they're wailing about is a mere $9.25 a month. Compare that to the billions of dollars of fraud in the Pentagon budget, which Republicans approve without questioning. What is this sour, dark smudge on the souls of GOP officials that leads them to demean poor people, preventing them and our society from reaching our fullest potential? It's stupid, but it's also shameful.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Oregon legislative session ended yesterday. The legislature approved a $300 million bond for seismic upgrades to public schools. Representative Shamia Fagan voiced her support for seismic funding on the House floor.
After learning about the imminent danger of the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, I spent the last 2 years being the one in our family to buy solar-powered water filtration backpacks and battery chargers and dried goods. And no, I will not share which milepost the Fagan-Mon compound will be in the event of the earthquake. So taking earthquake preparation seriously, I reached out to the Oregon School Boards Association last summer to find out how I could assist their efforts to create a statewide grant fund for local school districts to upgrade school buildings. As a mom, as I'm sure all of you who are parents can't even entertain the thought of losing my little boy. So I jumped at the chance to co-sponsor this grant fund with Senator Devlin. And as recently as last week when I met with OSBA, they were excited about the prospect of $50 million in the grant fund. So to see the final number actually reach $125 million with a special formula to make sure that low-income school districts have an equal opportunity to those funds is an enormous win for Oregon kids. So that's the first reason I support this package. The second reason I support this bonding package is the $17 million that will be allocated to construct Outer Powell Boulevard. I remember during my first campaign when I was pregnant, very pregnant, and I was canvassing on Powell Boulevard, and I had two choices. I could walk in a bike lane next to cars traveling 35 to 50 miles an hour, or I could walk through a strip club parking lot. Those were my only two options to walk on Powell. And at that moment, I had the thought that this is some kid's walk to school and from school every day, strip club parking lot or bike lane next to a highway. Given the fact that the community has been told for about 30 years that Powell Boulevard is 15 to 20 years away, and being told that recently, it was important that we act. And so I want to express my great appreciation both to the Senate and to the House for putting this money for Powell Boulevard in there. This will allow for, with the $3 million the City of Portland has allocated, will allow for full funding for a transformation of Powell Boulevard starting at Southeast 122nd and East to 136th. And this is fitting, given that according to ODOT, Southeast Powell Boulevard and 122nd is the most dangerous intersection in the state of Oregon.
The legislature voted no to another $300 million to remodel the state capitol. Also passed was a bill to help LGBT veterans upgrade less than honorable discharges based on sexual orientation. And another passed bill will create a hotline for strippers to report problems at their club.
Northwest Fisheries Science Center has mobilized extra scientists to join a fisheries study to chart an extensive, harmful algal bloom that stretches from the central California coast north to Washington and possibly Alaska. The bloom involves some of the highest concentrations of the natural toxin domoic acid ever observed in Monterey Bay and off the central Oregon coast. Microscopic diatoms produce domoic acid, and another form of marine microorganisms called dinoflagellates produce other types of toxins called paralytic shellfish toxins, or PSTs. Shellfish and other plankton-feeding fish, such as anchovies and sardines, can concentrate the toxins and transfer them to other marine animals. Unusually warm ocean temperatures that have dominated the West Coast since last year may have led to the current bloom. In early June, the multi-million-dollar Dungeness crab industry was closed along the southern Washington coast due to elevated levels of toxins, and all coastal Washington beaches have been closed to razor clamming. Officials in Oregon have halted all shellfish harvesting from the Columbia River south to Tillamook Head and closed the entire state coastline to razor clamming because of elevated levels of domoic acid. High levels of PSTs have also led to the closure of mussel harvesting along the Oregon coast north of Gold Beach.
At least 9 fin whales have been discovered floating dead in waters from Kodiak to Unimak Pass since late May. 2 were washed ashore after floating in the water for a week. Kate Wynn, a professor and marine mammal specialist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, said, "We rarely see more than one fin whale carcass every couple of years. Fin whales, an endangered species, grow to 70 feet long. They use baleen in their mouths to strain copepods, krill, and small fish from seawater. The whales feed in tight formations, so Wynn thinks the dead whales could have consumed something toxic around the week of May 20th. Wynn said, "It is perplexing for a number of reasons. They appear to have all died around the same time, and the strange thing is they are all one species. People are being asked to watch for dead birds, fish, or anything that seems unusual to determine if it's related to the dead whales, but so far there is no smoking gun in this environmental mystery."
And now, something a little different from H2O Radio, This Week in Water.
Did the feds let BP off the hook? That and other stories for the week ending July 5th, 2015. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Last week, BP agreed with the federal government and five state governments to settle claims resulting from the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. The rig explosion killed 11, and the resulting spill released 4.2 million barrels of oil into the Gulf.
BP is agreeing to pay $18.7 billion in fines and restitution, but not immediately. The oil giant will have 15 years to make payments, most of which will be tax deductible.
This amount may seem a little too low to some, considering BP's profits in the single year of 2011 were $7 billion higher than the amount it agreed to pay over many years.
According to the New York Times, Wall Street analysts declare the settlement a victory for the company compared to the potential damages it could have faced.
Governors of the states involved in the settlement hailed it. Others have claimed BP is getting off light.
The National Wildlife Federation had estimated that BP could have been liable for more than $30 billion. A spokesperson for Oceana in the U.S. said that under the settlement, BP will not be fully compensating for the damages it caused.
BP said in a statement that the impact of the settlement on the company's balance sheet and cash flow will be manageable and will allow BP to continue to grow its business.
BP is now back to drilling in the Gulf with 8 rigs operating, but many of the ongoing impacts of the 2010 disaster will not be known for decades. Ever since the city of Detroit threatened to shut off water to people's homes for non-payment of their bills, there have been calls to make water there more affordable.
In Detroit, while affordability is drawing attention, about 70 miles away in Flint, the issue is not only affordability, but water quality.
The city of Flint recently switched to using the Flint River as its source of drinking water. But residents say that since the change, they've had to deal with rashes, hair loss, muscle stiffness, and soreness, not to mention complaints about taste and color. And the cost is high. The average monthly water bill for residents in Flint is $140.
On July 3rd, a group of activists set out to walk 10 miles a day from Detroit to Flint to show solidarity in the struggle for clean and affordable water.
In Detroit, the activists' efforts may be paying off. Last week, the city council rejected a proposed water rate increase of 7.5%, in part, some say, due to dissatisfaction with the water department's efforts to help those who can't afford water at current rates.
One of the people involved in the 70-mile walk, Lila Kabil, called it a journey to make sure that there is the kind of moral justice there should be around water.
The city of Lockport, a suburb southwest of Chicago, is being limited by federal and state officials in where it can dig public water wells. Why? Because of all things, an endangered dragonfly.
The Heinz Emerald Dragonfly isn't just any dragonfly. It's one of the rarest on Earth and thought to be extinct until some were discovered in the Des Plaines River Valley in 1988.
State and federal agencies created a buffer zone around an island in the river to protect the insect, specifically its larvae that depend on groundwater-fed wetlands. And it's that protection that's limiting where Lockport engineers can dig their wells.
And apparently it's too much to bear for the city. The Chicago Tribune reports that Lockport Mayor Steve Streit is calling on state and federal officials to defend their stance and to answer the question, what happens if it comes down to choosing between the dragonfly and people having access to drinking water?
It should be noted that according to the city administrator Ben Benson, Lockport has no current need for more water. But as the city approves more and more plans for residential subdivisions and industrial developments, water demand will grow.
According to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the Heinz emerald dragonfly used to be widespread in the Midwest and South, but most of its habitat has been drained and filled to make way for development.
But Lockport should realize that the dragonfly is a friend with benefits, such as catching and eating mosquitoes, biting flies, and gnats. Not to mention, they're also an important food source for aquatic animals.
But probably the most important role they play is as water quality monitors. If they're not thriving, it could indicate larger problems of groundwater contamination from pesticides and urban runoff.
And speaking of insects, finally this week, if you're an arachnophobe, you have our permission to turn down the radio. This story might give you the willies.
If you thought a good way to avoid spiders might be to get in the water, turns out that spiders are quite impressive mariners and can sail across large bodies of water like ships, using their legs to catch the wind and their silk to tether to a floating object.
That's according to a new study by researchers at the University of Nottingham's Spider Lab, published in the journal BMC Evolutionary Biology. The scientists found that when placed in water, more than a third of spiders adopted yoga-like postures that allowed them to use the wind to glide across the surface.
For example, the spiders did handstands to allow their abdomens to catch the wind, while others simply ran across the surface, essentially walking on water. The research helps explain why spiders have been amongst the first to colonize new habitats and why many species are found all over the globe.
Scientists already knew that terrestrial spiders had the ability to travel through a technique called ballooning, where the creatures use their silk to fly through the air. But a downward-facing dog on water? That's a new one. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more ColoradoWaterWise.org.
Heroin use is on the rise, according to a new report by the Federal Centers for Disease Control. The rates of past year heroin use in the U.S. increased across almost all study groups. However, the greatest increases were among those that historically